Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Greetings and thank you for joining us. Our guests are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet, Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News, and joining us from Washington, D.C. by Skype, Libby Casey of the Alaska Public Radio Network. The Ted Stevens air crash receives a lot of attention this week. Federal officials have examined the causes of the crash and they have been unable to come to a definitive conclusion about what happened. Libby, you covered the hearing. What did you see?
A lot of frustration and disappointment on behalf of the NTSB folks who wish they could have a definitive solution here, but they just don't. They're using the phrase probable cause, and they say that it's likely that the pilot, Terry Smith, became temporarily unresponsive in the moments before the crash. But the chairwoman of the NTSB, Deborah Hirschman, said it is really unusual to invest so much manpower and brain power into an investigation and not be able to say what really happened. One of the other folks in the NTSB board commended the investigators and said, it is so hard for these detectives to work this hard and say, we don't really know. And you only do that when you have to. Here are some of the theories. The pilot changed course at the last moment, went into this left turn, and then, as we all know, hit basically a mountainside in southwest Alaska. And they don't know why he became unresponsive. They can rule out a few things. They can rule out a mechanical problem. They're ruling out weather. They are looking at a couple of things about the pilot. One, and this is probably the biggest one, he'd had a stroke 4 years prior to the crash. He had, though, been given an all clear by a doctor. Now, what NTSB is saying is that there need to be more rigorous standards put in place for when someone is recertified to fly after having a stroke, because it was actually a pediatrician who signed off on him and didn't do some of the cognitive investigations and testing that the NTSB would like to see mandatory. About a month before the crash, he was reported by a couple of witnesses to just be acting a little off, a little strange. One said that he had this moment where he almost seemed like an Alzheimer's patient. But in general, Terry Smith was reported to be vibrant, lively, very with it. They also looked into his mental health. They said that although he'd experienced the recent tragic death of a son-in-law, in a plane crash, that he was really dealing with his grief effectively and in a really sort of typical way, a very healthy way. So they sort of ruled that out. And then they just looked at sleepiness. Was he tired? And they just couldn't come to an answer.
Thank you, Libby. Paul, is this a reminder yet again that what happens in the cockpit is frequently a mystery that nobody can answer?
I think in the split seconds before a crash, before an incident, things are going on, people are acting or not reacting. It's all happening so fast, and the forces involved are we're so unable to really comprehend the forces involved that things do happen that we'll never ever figure out what it was, no matter how hard we try or how much time and money we spend.
Okay. Steve, where does this leave the survivors and the families of those who died?
I'm not really sure. Not having talked to any of the family members, you know, you would like to hope that it gives them some closure, but I don't know how that would work. They still don't really know what caused this. I think that they can take some solace, however, in knowing that the NTSB truly did a full court press on this to try to determine exactly what went wrong here. They allocated a lot of resources, a lot of very good investigators from Alaska, Lower 48. They all tackled this. They did this in 9 to 10 months. Normally, it takes about a year or so before we get a report like this. They held this hearing in Washington, D.C., which doesn't happen all the time. So they gave this special treatment because of who was on the airplane, former Senator Ted Stevens. So I think that the families can at least take solace in the fact that the NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board, did, I think, everything in its power to try and learn the cause of this. And
Michael, if I could say one thing. Sorry, Steve.
Yeah, no, go
ahead.
I
actually was able to talk with Jim Moorhart, one of the survivors of the crash, who came to the hearing along with the Stevens family. And he is really focused on just getting through the healing process. He broke so many bones. Mm-hmm. and a punctured lung and had really serious injuries. And when I tried to pin him down, though, and say, look, do your memories jive with what the NTSB is saying, he really wouldn't say. He just kept emphasizing the loss of not just Ted Stevens, but four other people, and wouldn't get pinned down, which was sort of interesting. So you have to wonder if there is going to be any legal process here or what's going to happen next.
Yeah.
Steve, you want to finish up? Go ahead.
One closing point to the NTSB, which it does in many of these investigations. It came up with a series of recommendations that it feels that could help or maybe at least shed light on future crashes should they happen, but they're saying, you know, sort of a mini black box to go in some of these airplanes, or cameras in the cockpit that would at least show what was going on. You know, not all, you know, in the past it's been pilots have said no, this is too expensive, and truly in years past they have been $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, and that's a lot of money. Now they're down to, thanks to advances in technology, they're down to about $1,000, according to what Deborah Hersman said at the NTSB hearing. So some pilots are still saying that's a lot of money. Some say it's an invasion of privacy. They don't want a camera or a microphone recording what they say in their planes. But I think the thought by the NTSB is that it could shed light on, God forbid, another accident like this or any other accident happening again. Maybe they are able to determine what happened and prevent another crash from happening.
Thank you, Steve.
One other thing, if I could just mention this, the plane's terrain awareness and warning system, or TAWS, was turned off, had its auditory alerts turned off, which is very typical in Alaska because you're going so close to terrain, you're not just flying over cornfields. So a lot of pilots turned that signal off, but the NTSB folks said that could have given the pilot 30 seconds warning that he was headed towards a mountainside. So equipment maybe could have come in more handy if there had been better equipment on board. I do want to say one thing about the pilot. Very experienced, highly skilled in that part of Alaska, and had worked for Alaska Airlines, had a very successful career. So the NTSB was very careful to praise him and say that despite this error, they don't want to just cast a black light on who he was.
Yeah, Libby, just to follow up to him on that box that calls out where you are with the terrain. We had a charter pilot tell us yesterday that it makes the passengers in the plane nervous because this thing's always going off saying, you know, you're close to terrain or whatever, you know, and so he just like turns it down or turns it off because, and he's out there, obviously a very good pilot and a very experienced pilot, and so he's visually checking everything, but to have this thing going off in the cockpit all the time made his passengers nervous.
Then the pilot has to sit there and say, don't worry about it. It's nothing. This must be accident week, Paul. Five commercial clammers die in a boating accident near Anchorage. It came as quite a surprise. Not only were we surprised by this terrible accident, but the fact that there is a pretty extensive clamming industry or business here in South Central Alaska. Tell us about the accident.
Well, Pacific Alaska Shellfish has been clamming commercially in Cook Inlet since 1983. It's got a 70-year history with not a fatality. One of their 22-foot skiffs with five people aboard and carrying probably 35 buckets of clams at about, 100 pounds apiece, were headed back to the shop after clamming all day. A sixth clammer said, no, I'm not getting on that. I'll walk, thanks, and took the long way around. So he was alive to tell.
That's part of the remarkable part of the
that
story.
Is remarkable. Mm-hmm. Talk about just using your judgment.
Yeah.
Troopers say that it's likely that a wave came over the bow of the boat and it was overloaded and that it swamped it. We had five people on board. One person was wearing a life vest. Nobody was wearing a survival suit. And in the waters of Cook Inlet, as we're all really aware, it doesn't take long for you to get in real trouble. And that's pretty much where it is. I was even unaware we had a commercial claiming thing in Cook Inlet, but apparently it's been going on out there a good long while.
Steve, do we know if this industry is regulated, if there are labor inspections? We do know that these are not formerly employees, they're contractors, the workers.
Right, and some of them have been working out there for a good long time, 10, 20 years, I think. And is the industry regulated? I'm not completely sure of that, but
it would depend on what your definition is, I suppose.
Right, and you can be regulated. Are those regulations followed? Paul just mentioned, one person had a life jacket on. The Coast Guard's been quoted as saying everybody should have been wearing a life jacket on this. Now, the old Alaskan argument, well, is it going to help you in that cold water? But the point is it increases your chances. So everybody should have had a life jacket on, according to the Coast Guard. Then some say that they should have all had survival suits on as well. Was that boat overloaded? Argument may be made in that favor as well. Yeah, it was perhaps overloaded.
And so we'll have more discussion. This is not the end of it, right?
Troopers, Coast Guard, all investigating this.
Okay, once again, I'm Michael Carey. I'm here with Paul Jenkins, Steve McDonald, and Libby Casey. Libby, let's go back to you. There were two, not one, but two hearings on, two Sea Alaska land bills. We received hearings this week. I'll get it straight yet. Perhaps you could tell us about those bills, the hearings, and what are the prospects for this legislation, which Sea Alaska has been pursuing for quite some time.
That's right. The Native Corporation in Southeast wants to get the choice of lands in the Tongass National Forest. It's very controversial in Southeast. Some community residents, including a group of nine communities who sent someone here to Washington, kind of passed the hat to be able to afford to send her here, Myla Polstra from Edna Bay, say that they're afraid it will actually hurt potential timber and logging because they think the Forest Service has a decent plan for reviving the logging industry. They're worried that Sea Alaska is going to send the logs overseas instead. And they're afraid by cutting down trees that it will hurt tourism, it will hurt guiding, it will hurt hunting and things like that. The Native Corporation says, you know, we were here to begin with, it's our right, we need through ANCSA, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, to wrap this up and get this done. Senator Murkowski held a bunch of listening sessions over the past year in Southeast and came up with a revised bill, which had a hearing this week. Congressman Don Young says, I don't care. I don't care that it's controversial. I'm sticking with the old version of the bill, and I'm going to get it passed. He wants to try to get it through by December. The 40th anniversary of ANCSA comes in this year, whereas Senator Murkowski seems still willing to work on this a little bit.
Libby,
the hearings were interesting but different in tone.
May I ask you something real quickly?
Sure.
It's pretty obvious that Senator Murkowski has to get help from Democrats to get this bill even to the floor. Is that something that's a prospect for her? And Don Young's bill is the same thing. He can pass it in the House, but the Democrats control the Senate. So give us some sense of where the Democrats are here.
Yeah, this is a very interesting point. The delegation is pitching this as a pro-Native bill, and there's not, I don't think, clarity among other members of Congress outside Alaska of the difference between a Native corporation and a Native tribe. And so a lot of the House members, including Democrats, were really lambasting the conservationists and other activists who were here opposing the bill. Don Young even yelled at one point to a resident from Craig, who was here saying, this bill doesn't work for me, and accused him of trying to destroy Native people. So if they can get pro-Native legislators, Democrats, on board, this could go somewhere. The question is, how much of a force will the environmentalist groups be able to get other Democrats, the Barbara Boxers out there, to fight it and not allow it to pass? There's a lot of framing going on, a lot of political playing. But Don Young was really on a tear yesterday, and because the Republicans control that House committee room, the gentleman who was getting yelled at didn't have a chance to defend himself when he was told that he was trying to destroy Native culture.
A new development for Congressman Don Young. Libby, at the same time, we had a vote on Medicare this week in the Senate. Senator Harry Reid, the majority leader, called it up in a big hurry after a New York State congressional race went Democratic, presumably on the Medicare question. And what do you know? Senator Lisa Murkowski voted with the Democrats to defeat the so-called Paul Ryan Medicare bill. This was, for most of us up here, an unusual development. What can you tell us?
Yeah, well, Paul Ryan's plan passed the House, but ran into trouble in the Senate, where it did fail with the help of five Republicans. You mentioned Murkowski. The others were the two main senators, Susan Collins and Olympia Snow, also Scott Brown of Massachusetts. And then a little bit different, Rand Paul of Kentucky said this actually doesn't go far enough. But the other ones, including Murkowski as a block, said they have concerns about what the Ryan plan would do to Medicare. And there's a lot of talk about if it would turn Medicare into a voucher system. And she says she doesn't feel comfortable with that. So this is one of those Lisa Murkowski in the post writing campaign era going a slightly different way. She also struck out against her party on a vote over a judge last week. While she didn't support the liberal judge, she said, look, we shouldn't be filibustering these things. Let's just have an up or down vote. So I'm going to vote to advance.
Yeah, this was to the appointment to the Ninth Circuit.
That's right, to the Ninth Circuit, which affects Alaska, and the judge is from Berkeley. But Senator Murkowski said, I don't want to keep dickering around. I want to just give judges an up or down vote. I believe that since George Bush was president, that my viewpoint hasn't changed just because we have a Democrat in the White House. Let's stop the politics and let people vote their conscience. So she was one of very few people to do that. So we're seeing a little bit different thing going on here. She did vote, when we talk about Medicare and budgets, for a budget plan put out by a Republican senator from Pennsylvania, Pat Toomey, which was a lot of cutting, but not with the Medicare component.
Thank you, Libby. Steve, is the legislature headed for a special session for its second time? And what are the consequences of the coastal zone management controversy, which has come up here suddenly?
They're polling members now. In the House, I think they've got 15 for sures. They've got to come up with a few more. I'm not sure exactly where it stands in the Senate at this point. But the legislature is polling itself to go back into a possible second special session. The governor says he's not going to call it. But the legislature could call itself back if it can get two-thirds of each house to comply. And it's over this coastal zone management bill, which sunsets on July 1st of this year. And it's over just how much say would rural communities have in issues like oil development, resource development, offshore, along the shorelines, what have you. One hand says, well, hey, this is affecting us. We could have oil rigs going up just outside our front doors here. There's fishing to be talked about, maybe whaling as well. And we should have a definitive say in some of these things. And there are folks like Governor Parnell who say, yeah, you should have a say, but not too much of a say, because we don't want to stymie the whole process. We feel we want to make a decision. And, of course, we know how quickly Alaskans come to decisions on issues like this. I'm joking about that. I guess I was going to go home tonight on the Kinnickarm Bridge, but I'm not going to do that. But, so we don't make decisions really quick, and a lot of folks feel that this could slow down that even more. Somehow you can do that.
Thank you, Steve. Paul, ID checks for alcohol purchases in package stores becomes law. The Assembly passes this measure 10-1. Tell us about it, and what are the consequences?
Well, there was an advisory vote by the populace, if you will, during the last election. People want ID checks at liquor stores. They tried to expand that to restaurants and bars, but gave it up and stuck with liquor stores. And with the overriding terrible problems Anchorage has, I think, with alcoholism, drivers and homeless camps and people standing on corners begging money for booze, I think they felt they had to do something. So a 10-1 vote, Bill Starr voting no, I guess is not surprising. I guess it's disappointing in the sense that it's probably not the best tack to deal with this stuff, but they felt they had to do something, and this is what they did.
Steve, is there any way to measure the effectiveness of checks of this kind? Many of the people are the same old people going in day after day after day. They're getting checked. The person there behind the counter has looked at them 100 times.
Yeah, I think if they can quantify and say, oh, you've got a red stripe on your license, which means that you can't buy alcohol, and if they can just say how many denials we had, I guess you can quantify it that way.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I guess if you could say, the number of DUIs has gone down. I guess you could quantify it that way. This is another tool in the bag. This is a wide-ranging problem. There is no one answer that's going to solve all of this, because it truly is so pervasive in our community. But I do think that this is a step forward. I do think it's another tool in the bag.
And if I might, Steve, that the bars and restaurants got what they wanted out of this, because the legislation was not extended to bars and restaurants.
That's right. That was something Dick Traney wanted to do when he was the Assembly Chairman. He wanted to expand it. And it was right after the election. There was an advisory vote. Anchorage voters came out and said, yeah, we want to extend this, or we want to have this to where everybody is carded at a package store. Mr. Traney decided that he was going to expand it to restaurants and to bars and things like that. This was kind of a compromise that was offered by Mr. Trombley, one of the newest members of the Assembly. He was the one who came out with it, and backed by the mayor. And so this was what was voted on overwhelmingly. And this, man, it's I think this is what the people of Anchorage voted for, and this is what should happen. We'll see how it goes, see how it works.
Libby, let's skip ahead. Frank Bailey is hawking his book on Sarah Palin. Remind us, who is Frank Bailey, and what does he have to say as he's making the rounds of the TV shows and newspapers back east to tell the rest of the world about Sarah Palin as if the rest of the world doesn't know enough?
Well, Frank Bailey worked under Palin as her director of boards and commissions. He worked on her campaign. He worked in the administration. And he has written a kiss and tell, political kiss and tell book about Palin called Blind Allegiance. And he has in it over 50,000 emails between himself and the governor and folks related to both the campaign and her being in office as governor. And it's very revealing. Very behind the scenes, and he paints a picture of someone who is, in his perspective, vindictive, not that interested in governing, and more interested in sort of being famous and the power that comes with it. Now, he's really been hawking his book. I mean, it's a good word to use because he's been all over the network TV down here on the East Coast, and I think he says, my book, about 10 times every sentence, which I guess is what you do when you're selling a book. But he's gotten
that phone
a lot
number
of play,
is
especially in liberal media.
Okay. Meanwhile, Steve McDowell, Sarah Palin has moved to Arizona, or more accurately, she's purchased a $1 million-plus house in southern Arizona.
Yeah.
And there is talk that she's going on a bus tour.
Yeah.
That goes to New Hampshire as well as other places.
First of all, let's
bifurcate the question here. Is she becoming a resident of Arizona? Mm-hmm. And second, what does the tour tell us? Is this woman running for something?
Well, first of all, a lot of Alaskans are buying property in Nevada, Arizona, and California because the economy down there has depressed the housing market, so it's a great deal. So I don't know if she's doing that. I don't think it's a vacation home kind of thing. Maybe it's a base of operation. That's what other people are saying, that she'll be in.
And Steve, if I might, it's not surprising that affluent Alaskans buy property in warm places.
Sure, and this is it's a buyer's market down in those places. Our economy is pretty good. Their economy, like I said, housing prices are down, so maybe it's a good investment. Obviously there's going to be a lot of folks who say that this is going to be, the base of operation out of the lower 48 to launch a campaign. Who knows? Time will tell. Supposedly she's got this bus tour that she's going to be going on. There is a fellow by the name of Steve Bannon, who is a conservative supporter. He's a conservative. I don't know if he's a filmmaker or not, but anyway,
he's made other films.
He is, so we'll call him a conservative filmmaker. He is he's creating a 2-hour-long documentary about Sarah Palin and her career and her life, and he wants to trot this out in Iowa to introduce voters in Iowa to Sarah Palin and rekindle.
Features
the
Johnny
base.
Depp as Steve McDonald. Is that how this works?
Yeah, right. Only if he looks like the pirate in the Pirates of the Caribbean movie. So there's a lot of things happening, and it's really got the pundits all talking about it. That's for certain. MSNBC, NBC, they're all talking about this and speculating whether she's going to make a run for it.
I can hear Chris Matthews now. He's Paul Jenkins for his assessment.
Huh? I don't think she can help herself. It's difficult when you sit back and look at this with the movie, with the bus tour, mm-hmm. with the new house. When you look at what she's actually done. She doesn't have a campaign organization in Iowa. She doesn't have one anywhere that anybody's aware of. She only recently hired a new chief of staff. She's got a new foreign policy advisor, and she's making noises like she knows something about foreign policy. But she has done nothing really concrete. You have to ask yourself, is she going to run, or is she just seeking attention at this point to try to burnish her soaring negatives across the country? She has books to sell. She doesn't need to be hated by everyone. So is this a way for her to get back in the good graces of the public, or is she setting up to run? I got to tell you, and I've said this from day one, I'll say it again, she's going to run because she can't help herself. She's going to do it.
She's just the type of person who would do that, I guess. Is what
she's just Paul.
I hope she does. It'll be the most interesting presidential race ever.
Let's get Libby Casey back in here. Libby, I'm going to take a wild guess here that the television networks, especially the political shows, are just going to find her bus tour irresistible, regardless of the motive. It's a great television opportunity, it seems to me, and for reporters.
It is, and there's sort of a, I mean, look at the Republican field here. There's a big guessing game about who is going to run, who's going to step up. And she has, as Erica Bolstad reported in the Anchorage Daily News this past week, an uncanny sense of timing at times, you know? And so in this void of having Republican candidates who conservative Republicans are excited about, here comes Sarah Palin's bus tour. Now, Michael, the bus tour kicks off here Sunday in D.C., and I'd love to go, but I can't get anybody from Palin's circle to get back to me. So Alaska Edition viewers, Anchorage Edition viewers, if you know of someone in the Palin camp who can call me, you can find me at Lib Casey on Twitter. I mean, and this is revealing because people like me, the small town reporter, can't get into that circle. And so we'd love to do some stories on it, but there's so much interest in her, so much of a fervor, so many people knocking down her door that it's hard to get in. So
and briefly, what
maybe
kind
I'll
of
go on Sunday, maybe I won't.
What kind of in 15 seconds, what kind of event is it going to be Sunday? Just a kickoff?
Rolling Thunder, huge motorcycle rally here. A lot of veterans participate. Palin's going to be there. Will she be on a hog? We'll find out. The bus tour has great paintings all over it, and it'll be hitting the road, doing a lot of big national things.
This
like
is Sarah Palin, not just as Mama Grizzly, but Sarah Palin as Mama. And with that, we're out of here. Thank you very much for joining us on Alaska Edition. We'll be back next week.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.